Well, so welcome back, and you're probably returning from being slightly mad over the Thanksgiving break, having to struggle with this paper as you did. And bravo to all of you who have finished, and to anybody who hasn't yet finished, well, hurry and get it all in, because you don't want this hanging over your head. And we are still around halfway with Anna Karenina. And as the next few classes unwind and unfold, we'll talk a bit about the final exam and what you need to be thinking about in wrapping our course up. As with almost all my final exams, it will be cumulative and yet selective. And there will be comments that we make in class in the last week and a half or week should help you in figuring out what's the selectivity that we'll be doing. I do think that a final exam ought to test and solidify the impact that a course has had on you. And so that does not mean that I want effusions, but rather some solid discussions that will be based on your having actually read and taken to heart these novels. And I think they're worth your having done so. So we will frame some of those questions. Some will be short and some will be long as we go on in the next few classes. So now our work before us is to discuss Anna Karenina. And I wanted to just say a few words about the novel and encourage your discussion, interruption. And after that, while we'll hand the chalk over, as it were, or hand the magic marker over to Dr. Dupree, and anxiously await his vision of things. I think ours is complementary, to be sure, but I don't think that I've thought as thoroughly about the structure of the novel and technique of it as he has. So we saw at the beginning, it struck me that the beginning of the novel sets us up, as it were, for a kind of domestic comedy. Because of the jovial mood of Stiva, right? Of Oblonsky, I'm sorry, our beginning character. We have we're conducted into the novel with a sense of its comic resonance, but plays us false, as it were. The notion of adultery turns out, of course, not to be a light matter, but a serious matter. The character of Anna awaits us. We don't see her yet in the novel. All the social themes of the novel are unfolded first, before she appears. And when she appears, then suddenly the gravity of the novel shifts dramatically. And we want to look, perhaps, at that chapter 18 in which Anna appears, part one, chapter 18. I'm again working with a marked copy that's a little different in paging from the one I assigned.
It's on this one I started.
56. 56, uh-huh, thank you. And our translation is going to be a little different also, but the introduction of Anna, right? Vronsky followed the guard to the carriage, and at the door of the compartment he stopped short to make room for a lady who was getting out. With the insight of a man of the world, from one glance at this lady's appearance, Wronski classified her as belonging to the best society. He begged pardon and was getting into the carriage, but felt he must glance at her once more. Not that she was very beautiful, not on account of the elegance and modest grace which were apparent in her whole figure, but because in the expression of her charming face as she passed close by him, there was something peculiarly caressing and soft. As he looked round, she too turned her head, her shining gray eyes that looked dark from the thick lashes rested with friendly attention on his face, as though she were recognizing him, and then promptly turned away to the passing crowd, as though seeking someone.
Is that the first paragraph?
Yeah. Sorry, it's a little different, but it's you should recognize the eyes and the lashes and so forth.
I do recognize it, but I just can't find it.
No, if you have the Norton, it's page 56. In that brief look, Wronski had time to notice the suppressed eagerness which played over her face and flitted between the brilliant eyes and the faint smile that curved her red lips. It was as though her nature were so brimming over with something that against her will it showed itself now in the flash of her eyes and now in her smile. Deliberately, she shrouded the light in her eyes, but it shone against her will in the faintly perceptible smile. All right. The face of Anna is an announcement, right? It's an enunciation in the novel, and it, of course, is completely the change for Wronski. We also have to consider how she has arrived here by train, right? In the train station, the place of destination, the place of destiny. If we stop and think about the role of trains in the novels that we've seen so far, we would think of the idiot and of Anna. Of course, a very, very strong role in Anna. It plays a role, too, in Brothers Karamazov, but not quite as crucial. There is something tragic about trains, we have to say, right? And something that makes it worthwhile. That was it Lebedev that said that the train networks of Europe were actually the star wormwood in the apocalypse, right? Because there is something about trains that is of course relentless, full of momentum, like a tragic plot, right? In that it goes relentlessly toward a destination. There's nothing you can do about it, and of course it's fatal, right? In Anna Karenina, Tolstoy always adds something fatal to the train. As well, but it's also alienating, right? It takes you out of your contact and out of your context and propels you along toward something else. All right. The face of Anna is something also that stands out of its context and changes everything. She is, just to look at her as a character, a noble character, right? We see her in this charming face. And yet at the same time, there is something that she's fighting with inside her own nature, right? That we see already, even though nothing yet has happened between her and Wronski. So for Tolstoy, one's nature, one's character is unfolded from within, right? And we see the kind of character that Aristotle calls, you know, a worthy tragic hero or heroine, as the case may be, because of the nobility of her. At the same time, of course, a terrific foreshadowing of the entire plot in the fact that the train runs over a peasant and cuts him in two, right? Or so they're said.
Where is this?
This is the accident that happens in the station where she is. She gets off the train. It says, first of all, crushed, right? That he's been crushed, but there's a detail that says he was absolutely cut in two. Right? And so there's That certainly seems to be a strong image of severing, right? That is going to resonate throughout the novel, a novel of adultery, right? This is about severing things into, about severing persons into, ultimately. Right?
Page 59.
Thank you.
Yeah. So the theme of adultery in the is perhaps the classic theme in the 19th century in the European novel. And yet Dostoevsky avoids it entirely. This, on the other hand, Tolstoy has given it probably its most definitive treatment. So part of our understanding of the Tolstoy-Dostoevsky dichotomy has got to center on that notion. Why do you think adultery is such a key topic for the European novel? Yeah.
John, I thought you were going to say for Tolstoy.
Oh, no, well, you can tell me that.
Well, I think it's I don't know, they sound kind of crude. It's sort of one of those rich people problems. I don't know. like that would be like the ultimate tragedy for like a count like him or somebody.
So the middle class doesn't worry so much about it.
Well, I mean, Dostoevsky, you know, he was poor. He was in need of money a lot in his life or whatever. And so for him, tragedy is something a lot deeper. Like, oh, I may not be able to eat next week, rather than oh, my wife's been unfaithful to me.
Point taken.
It's different.
I'll accept that. Yeah. Uh-huh. Other additional comments?
Well, it's kind of the undoing of the fabric of society. You know, if you imagine the marriage is the unit of the home and the basic unit of humanity, you know, and how society would recognize someone's life, you know, by their marriage and family, then adultery would threaten the very foundations of that, as well as a conventional morality that would, and religion that would support it and defend it, and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Good. Yeah. Other comments? Think of of European society. What sort of pressures are brought to bear on the kind of society that gives birth to the 19th century novel that the novel comments on? And we think of one in which, on the one hand, you have the tension here between law, between the social contract itself, the novel. As far as Europe is concerned, is about the social contract. Everything is about the social contract, right? And this is one of the most intimate and hard-hitting ways that it can be broken. Right? And yet, what's it broken in the name of? Right? What's it broken in the name of? And that, in fact, is of course what Tolstoy is exploring here as well. It seems to be broken. It claims to be broken for love. Right? In fact, it seems always broken for individualism, right? And of course the rising theme of European society. So I think all of that is places marriage and adultery at the center of the novel. Yes, huh?
It seems very dialogical, the society versus the person, and they're in a relation, and how the consequences for the actions of one have consequences for the other, and that seems dialogical to me, but maybe I don't understand what dialogical means, because Tolstoy is supposed to not be dialogical, right?
Yeah. Please, Scott.
Well, his narrator is not dialogical, but the presentation of themes definitely is.
Okay.
Yeah. So what Bakhtin means by the monological is the imposition of an overt voice that controls everything. But in this novel, you see that the voice is an omniscient voice, an omniscient narrator, but he doesn't control anything. He can reveal what people are thinking, but he's not without, the voice itself has sympathy with even Karenin, the husband, at times anyway, and with Anna. So there's not a set of absolutely bad characters and absolutely good characters. And society is sometimes bad and sometimes good, and individuals are sometimes bad and sometimes good.
Right.
So it, the what you're referring to as the dialogical nature of it is, in fact, these necessary conjunctions of two different forces or two different ideas or two different tendencies. They can't exist one without the other. And I think that's perfectly true.
So.
So there.
So that answers it, I think. Yeah. So, again, also we want to look at Tolstoy's technique here. If we look at chapter 22, his revelation of Anna. That we have her black dress, right? And this is again a carefully rendered realism that Tolstoy
page 72
uses. Thank you, page 72, near the end of chapter 22. It's in the middle of a paragraph, right? That Kitty had been seeing Anna every day. It's at, just the one before that, I'm sorry. Anna was not in lilac, the color Kitty was so sure she ought to have worn, but in a low-necked black velvet dress, which exposed her full shoulders and bosom that seemed carved out of old ivory, and her rounded arms with the very small hands. Her dress was richly trimmed with Venetian lace, and her black hair, all her own, she wore a little garland of pansies, and in her girdle, among the lace, a bunch of the same flowers. Her coiffure was very unobtrusive. The only noticeable things about it were the willful ringlets that always escaped at her temples and on the nape of her neck and added to her beauty. Round her finely chiseled neck, she wore a string of pearls. And so, all this, an image that is one that stays in our mind of what makes her both incredibly attractive, again with an impression of nobility, right, and the willful tendrils of hair that are going to give her trouble, as it were. They seem to stand for a nature that she cannot, discipline cannot hold down, but must give free rein to. Well, so we have, it seems to me, the themes are fairly clear in the novel, and they are, of course, passion versus marriage, and with the notion that marriage is a work that must be worked on, and this is tied at the same time to a strong opposition in Tolstoy between gratification of self and submersion of self. Right? Submersion of self to family, to community, to the demands of nature. Right? But only in those things, he suggests, can happiness be found. Those kinds of opposition polarize everything. So we have an opposition between city and country, right? In, of course, an opposition ultimately between the Anna plot and the Levin plot, or Jovan plot, an opposition of the peasant and the civilized man. Appreciation of the peasant is extremely important, and for Levin, all wisdom, all moments of wisdom and insight come in some sort of dealing, either directly from the peasant or in dealing with them. And there's a theme that runs through this of new ways and old ways, right? Of marriage customs, agricultural reforms rejected by the peasants, of medicine, and the rationalism of Levin's brother, Sergei, about running things out in the country versus the traditional way of Levin. So on that, of course, it seems more neutral and more just as though Tolstoy is portraying the scene, but it all, it's all comes together in the overall portrait that Tolstoy is giving of, that's at the same time a portrait of Russia and a portrait of the human soul. And we begin to see this only through Levin and the his discontent, right? So it's his feelings of ineptness, right? His awkwardness and lack of manners, his refusal to accept forms as truthful. Right? Instead, he's constantly looking for something that is truer underneath the forms, and in disgust, he quits the world of the city, quits his attempt to win Kitty, and goes off and sulks in the country, but goes off to tend to things as well. Though he thinks he's despairing, his movement, it turns out, is toward wholeness and love. And so we have a very simple two counter movements that run throughout the novel. Levin's is a movement toward a union of impulse and form or formality, whereas Anna is absolutely forced to choose impulse and to reject form. Desire and restraint move together in Levin's life, body and mind, whereas they sunder themselves increasingly in the life of Anna. As beautiful, noble, and happy as she seems at the beginning, it's a movement steadily away from that. So, now this is not the idiot, this is not the possessed, and this is not even Flaubert's Madame Bovary, which often one is tempted to compare Anna Karenina to. This is not a society, in other words, that the novelist is convinced wholeness and integration are impossible. This is not a society in utter upheaval. Certainly, Tolstoy takes a critical look at his society, and he shows it to be fracturing under the strain of Europeanization, the new incoming methods, industrial revolution, and so forth, new mores, and so forth. And yet, with Levin, we begin to see his vision that personal integration is still possible. So this movement toward wholeness is, I think, a great kind of commanding vision for Tolstoy. In that regard, we look back to the first sentence. Once again, we see it in a slightly different light than we've been seeing it. Another dimension of it. Happy families are all alike, not simply because society demands, but because we're made that way. Right? That is to say, the great archetypes by which we find our true being are the same the world over. Sounds deceptively uninteresting. Love, fidelity, sexuality, childbearing, right? Always a tension, always a compensation between things, good food, festivity, death, grief. Right? All part of a cycle, the shared rhythms of life that we long for. And when we become too individualized, we are unhappy. So thus seems to be Tolstoy's message. Levin is his searcher. Levin is looking for these archetypes. But he mistrusts them, and he doubts their genuineness. The novel shows him gradually coming around. So main lines of the novel, I think, concern the downward path of a beautiful, noble, westernized woman, right? We see how much freedom she has, who loses by trying to gain everything, by you know, that elusive happiness that convinces her that she is unhappy, makes her unable to see her husband for what he is and for who he is, changes him through that misperception. And so a downward spiral is induced. And the gradual upward trajectory of a straightforward young man who thinks that he's always losing. And their young man, by the way, is Russian to the core in that he believes in, and that Tolstoy shows him, winning by submitting. Victory through suffering has been the message ever since Prince Igor. So, a tragic woman, we might say, and an epic man. Perhaps we might say Tolstoy's view of Russia, that if Levin is our positive hero, right, however, he's not one who can go out there and actively do something with the society. He does it in a rural setting, in an agricultural setting, agrarian. Right. And he makes it, the life of the peasants is happy with his organization. The life of his marriage is happy through him. So it's only in that small unit that the positive hero for Tolstoy can exist. But again, I wonder whether we might not say that, again, woman in these novels, in all the novels we've read, perhaps, but I think again in Anna Karenina, represents the soul of the entire society, and where it is going, and the terrible, tragic loss that it suffers in that struggle for individuation, for freedom from the things that are perceived as having kept it back. Those are the two lines that Tolstoy would characterize as being the great lines of 19th century Russia. But I think also, again, we want to make a plea for Tolstoy's greatness here because we've been tilted our table toward Dostoevsky. Tolstoy is not simply an analyst of social mores. He is not simply a microscopic, brilliant portraitist of the real or of the conventional. He does make us look into our soul. As we begin to read this novel, it makes us look more deeply into, not our soul, I should say, it's not a personal experience, but into the human soul, into ourselves as part of the great design. And the kind of vision that he has, and we want to watch Levin on this, is what makes us see the mysterious laws that govern our lives. It's not a particularly Christian vision, but it is a transcendent vision of a sort. So, with that, I think I've said about all I want to.
Very good words indeed. Well, over the Thanksgiving holiday, I obtained a copy of Viktor Shklovsky's Energy of Delusion. The phrase comes from Tolstoy. And it was published in 1981, 2 years before he died. I didn't even know he was alive in the 1980s, so I was very surprised because his best-known work was done before or in the year 1917, just before the Russian Revolution.
Yeah.
The essays he wrote on artist technique and on Tristram Shandy and other things as part of the formalist school were all written then in this first couple of decades, even up to and into the 1920s after the revolution, when there was just an unbelievably rich group of intellectuals and critics and artists in Russia, much of which was utterly stamped out during the Stalinist period. Anyhow, in this book is a whole book on Tolstoy, but its subtitle is A Book on Plot. And I've only read the first 70 pages of it. I just got it yesterday. And I, of course, had to reread some Anna Karenina and do a few other things at the same time. So I'm hoping I'll have time to finish all 428 pages of it before the end of the semester. Unfortunately, I'm also editing a 1,300-page manuscript at the same time. All right, I want to quote from something here. It's a very strange book, by the way, I should say. I mentioned Ostrinenye, you know, this making strange. And what he does is to make, what Shklovsky also does, to make criticism, literary criticism, strange. So it's made up of sentence-long paragraphs throughout. There are a few, every now and then there's a paragraph, that is to say, either a very long sentence that's paragraph length, or that's a couple of sentences, but this is rare. So it's a very peculiar book, and it's he jumps from topic to topic. It's not a consecutive story, and in fact, he makes an important distinction that goes all the way back to the formalist in the first couple of decades of the 20th century, between, as they're translated here, story and plot. And I'll just mention these before I go in to talk a bit more about Anna Karenina itself. So story is a sequence of events in causal order. This causes this to happen, causes this to happen, causes this to happen. That's what Shklovsky and Eichenbaum and the others meant by story. Plot is the manner in which the story is conveyed to us so that we can have events out of order. We can have simultaneous events, for example, that are independent of one another, that don't cause one another. We can have elements that are not, strictly speaking, effects or causes in the course of the unveiling of the information that is there. Now, what's intrigued me in this book are two things that I've noticed so far, having read only the first seventh or so of the book. I have to say that first thing is that he quotes from the Apocalypse several times. And we've already seen that this apocalyptic theme runs throughout 19th and even 20th century Russian fiction. The other is that he sees in structure in literature not only a principle of organization, but a moral and larger cultural dimension. So that the difference between story and plot is in fact the difference between fate on the one hand, the railway tracks that we see in this novel and in Dostoevsky's that Dr. Cowan has already mentioned, where you go straight on through, and the freedom then to rework events so that you can present the conclusion first. And in fact, we know that Tolstoy, far from bumping Anna off at the end of the novel, this is not a spoiler, I suspect, had her a death in mind from the beginning. That was to be, even before he introduced the parallel plot of, and I'll call him Levin just to keep us on the same page here, pronunciation page. The Levin Kitty story then was not an afterthought, but a later thought that he introduced into it. Right? So for Shklovsky, and perhaps the other formalist, I'm not sure, then this these elements in literature are pieced together. And for Shklovsky, then the artist is not someone who creates a story. He's someone who creates a plot. And he says, you know, they all tell the same story. But he says, there is also what he calls the traveling plot. The organization of events that you can find in writer after writer, this plot. We all know that stories, of course, travel from place to place. But we don't think of the fact that plots also do this. And we may have the same plot with a totally different story. For Shklovsky, then, this chaos, this entanglement, is life. And there is parody, what he calls parody on the one hand, which is from parodos in Greek, which means rode alongside. Right? And so we can see that, though for us a parody is a version of a story that ridicules it to some extent, lowers it perhaps. But in another sense, in the Greek sense also, we can say that two stories that run alongside one another, even if they're not the same story, then can be parodies, parallel roads. So there is, on the one hand, parody, repetition of a structure, and then there is reinvention. And reinvention is necessary, as is the traveling plot or the traveling story. And so then Shklovsky goes on to say, you can take a picture from another writer, but you can treat it as though brand new. He gives the instance of a snowstorm from a memoirist by the name of Aksakov. And he says he has a realistic picture of a snowstorm, but it's a picture that's brand new, that was never described before in this way. And this is what he means by ostrenenie, then defamiliarization. So you may have seen a snowstorm, but you've never seen it in this way. It's defamiliarized, made fresh, and so on. So this is one way of explaining how we use the past. And there's something very like T.S. Eliot's notion in Tradition and the Individual Talent of tradition as being something that is modified every time a new work is added to the whole body of literature. Something very similar to this in Shklovsky's notions. And so he refers to tradition and the way in which an author pieces together works that were already canonized in the light of tradition. Now, what Shklovsky does then is to make a move in which he says, and this is human society. Here, the structure of literature mirrors exactly the way that human society has to work. That, in effect, imaginative literature then is another way of seeing ourselves in all of the complexity that comes about when we have human beings who interact with other human beings, who imitate other human beings, but who also seek out an original direction. So we have unpredictable people. Now, you remember Aristotle in the Poetics says that it doesn't matter whether or not something happened. In order for it to be a story that we will accept, it has to be probable. And he doesn't define probable necessarily in a statistical sense. Probability means that it chimes with our ordinary behavior or our usual expectations.
So Oedipus is probable?
No. No, it's not probable, is it?
No.
And yet, it is made to seem absolutely inescapable, you see. Aristotle's point here is that nothing in Oedipus happens by accident.
Oh, okay.
There is will involved at every stage of the way, and because there is will involved, there is catastrophe.
Mm.
So coincidences, mere coincidences, are ruled out, although they happen all the time in life. Accidents of certain kinds are ruled out. And everything has to fit with everything else in some fashion. And Tolstoy, responding to friendly criticism from fellow writers and readers, said, look, there is nothing. One of the criticisms was that the novel was too loose, that there are too many things going on that didn't relate to one another. And he said, oh no, everything relates to everything else. It's very interesting to see how tiny details that you don't notice, like the small bags that Anna carries around, or the way that she is described as having small hands, or the images of the bear in relation to Levin and Kitty that we don't even notice, are part of this motif that runs throughout and helps color and structure these sub-themes that tell us where they're going. But all these are very subtle. Now, Shklovsky says, every literary work is a brand new montage of the world. He's using montage. It was a term that was originally French, and it referred to film editing. But a montage also in the artistic sense. You remember the Cubists were operative at the same time that Shklovsky is writing in the early 20th century, where you paste things together, and at first they don't seem related to one another. And then when you look at them together, you begin to see the connection, though it may be an unstated or even a very oblique connection. All right, so every literary work is a brand new montage of the world, a new unpredictability, a new occurrence. And so he says, when we look at the history or the influences on a work, then we're not just being fuddy-duddy scholars. He says, we are explaining how thought emerges, how the past is related to the present, how the present is a renewed and refreshed view of ancient realities that don't change that much, but that have to be re-envisioned in order for us to see them as realities, as something permanent. So he says, thus, I'm like a guide through a museum or a city who explains why the streets curve. There used to be a wall here. Now we have gates, hence the curve of the street. There's an interesting book on city planning that I read long ago that explains why it is that you get streets, a whole grid of streets that meets another grid of streets at funny angles. If you look in downtown Dallas, you see this happening. You know what happens. They have one neighborhood that's set on a grid here and another neighborhood set on a grid here, and they expand on out and collide. So you can see the whole history of the city just in the layout of its streets. There was a bend behind the wall too, but that's because of the hill. The wall was bent according to the curve of the street. The curve of the street replicated the bend of the hill. He says, we have reached the history of writing Anna Karenina. And then he goes on to talk about Tolstoy's epigraph. And I mentioned that last time a bit. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. Tolstoy placed his epigraph the way he would hang a lock on the gates. An epigraph that's supposed to be the key to his work, the guide. It turned out to be a riddle. And you know now that Shklovsky is on the right track when he says that the epigraph is actually a riddle. And so then he explains what he's going to do in the rest of the book. A detailed discussion of Anna Karenina. Then he says, the unpredictable metamorphoses of the characters and their values, the locks and riddles of the heroes, their topicality. And I'm quoting him here, the novel is written through a method of inner monologues, i.e., the focal point in the novel, the setup of the camera keeps changing, and so do the ways of relating to the world. It is the multitude of methods of correlation that reveals the purpose of life. So structure here is intimately bound with insight. The very purpose of life is then incorporated into technique. He says, art is not just a way of relating to life, but also its montage. And if you understand that in the meaning of film editing, then it means that every time we make a work of art, we are editing life in a certain way as to give it not only meaning, but and not just an imposed meaning, you see, but a discovered meaning. Because we are bound by the past and by structures that we did not create and that we may challenge, rebel against, modify, but which we have to take into account. So he says, Anna Karenina opens as if from the world of Steva Oblonsky, the world of an estranged person who's made into a parody, a popular character. You know, your comment that at the first we think we're in a comic, of domestic, in a domestic comedy, matter of fact. But the popularity of this handsome, considerably young man's crisis is juxtaposed with his sister's tragedy. This is a montage. We'll have to understand it. And so he goes on to talk about frivolity. And then he quotes from Schopenhauer. Now, it turns out that Tolstoy was, in fact, reading Schopenhauer at the very time he was writing this novel. But he was reading other books, specifically the Odyssey, the Anabasis of Xenophon, the Aeneid, and Victor Hugo's Les Misérables, which means the poor in French, and not the miserable people, the poor people. All right, so he was reading these novels, and all these are epic in scope, and in fact, the first three are epics. But it's interesting that he's reading the Odyssey when he's writing this. By the way, he was reading it in a new Russian translation. He learned Greek because his son was studying Greek in school, and so he learned Greek alongside his son. And by the way, Dolly does exactly the same thing with her son when he's learning Latin in the novel. So you see these little glimpses that Tolstoy brings in from his own experience, but he casts them into the montage, that's the novel. And there they take on perhaps the same meaning they had for Tolstoy, but usually a very different meaning because they are placed in a different world. Anyway, he says, Anna Karenina is a novel of double standard morals. The cat and mouse game, where the mouse, the woman, is not allowed to pass, while the cat, the man, is so easily and fondly let through. Double standard. Schopenhauer held that adultery committed by men was natural, whereas for women, it was unnatural. And he goes on to say that Antonin Fet, who was a contemporary and friend of Tolstoy's, agreed with him and translated it into Russian, which Tolstoy read, although it's more likely that he read it in the original German, of course. And so he says, but speaking of Tolstoy as a phenomenon of historical continuity, and this is one of the interesting points that Shklovsky makes here, which is what I find interesting about Shklovsky's approach is it finally gives a critic a way of dealing with the usual scholarly apparatus that says, oh, Chaucer was influenced by Boccaccio here and so on and so forth. And the old-fashioned scholar thought that he had said everything that needed to be said. Look here, cause and effect. Chaucer was influenced by Boccaccio. Here, he got this tale from the Decameron, and he put it in the Canterbury Tales, so there. And what Shklovsky says is, no, look, you have to say that what we are looking at is the phenomenon of historical continuity. And what does that mean in relation to art? It's not just that there's an influence, it's that society itself is a phenomenon of historical continuity from generation to generation. Which epoch do you belong to as a writer? Your own? But not just your own, you see. The whole weight of the past is part of it as well. So each book in each epoch, he says, is a judgment on life. And incidentally, let's note how the structure of a trial, the speeches of the defendant and prosecutor, the defense and the accused has left its mark on or has been used in the history of the novel. See, so here's our polydigmatic structure already here. I'm willing to believe, perhaps, as I read through this book, that maybe Shklovsky anticipated me by quite a few decades. I'd be happy to discover that. It's a lot easier to quote somebody else than it is to make up something from scratch. All right. So anyway, enough of that for the moment. I want to explore the implications of this now by looking at specific passages. So let's look at page 115, chapter 4 at the beginning. The highest Peterburg society is really all one. All who belong to it know and even visit one another. But this large circle has its subdivisions. Anna Arkadyevna Karenina had friends and close connections in three different sets. So there are wheels within the wheel. One of these was her husband's official set, consisting of his colleagues and subordinates, who in most varied and capricious ways were connected and separated by social conditions. Anna found it hard now to recall the feeling of almost religious respect she had at first felt for these people. Now she knew them all as well as the inhabitants of a provincial town know one another. She knew the habits and weaknesses of each of them and where the shoe pinched this or that foot. She knew their relations to one another and to the governing center. She knew who sided with whom and how and by what means each supported himself and who agreed or disagreed with whom and about what. But, in spite of admonitions and advice from the Countess Lydia Ivanovna, this bureaucratic circle of masculine interest could not interest Anna, and she avoided it. All right, so she knows how it works. It's this little society within society with all its own rules. It's what now is referred to as business culture or government culture. The word culture now has been reduced in scope to cover these microcultures that are set up in societies. And Tolstoy is perfectly aware of the fact that all kinds of things that are determined by these, even though, even here, there is a great variety of differences. But nevertheless, everybody is aware of belonging to this group and that the little society within this society then has its own set of rules, its own set of behaviors, its own prescriptions, its own encouragements, its own glories, its own failures. Another circle with which Anna was intimate was that through which Karenin had made his career. So that's interesting. I thought he made his career in the government circles, where he's a very high-placed administrator or official. No, no. The center of that circle was the Countess Lydia Ivanovna. It consisted of elderly, plain, philanthropic, and pious women, and clever, learned, and ambitious men. So, clever, learned, and ambitious men choose what seemed to be rather safe wives. Plain,
elderly, philanthropic, pious, safe bets. And already we see the double standard in Anna Karenina that Shklovsky is speaking of, although the double standard there applying to gender is a little bit different from this one. Nevertheless, there are different rules for men and for women, naturally. And everybody knows this, even if they chafe at it or if they obey it unwillingly. Nevertheless, they're aware of it. Now, Tony Tanner, in a book that I think we mentioned before called Adultery in the Novel, which curiously enough mentions Anna Karenina once in a footnote, but which focuses on another story of Tolstoy's called the Kreutzer Sonata. It's a long short story or novella. And in it, a man who suspects that his wife has had an adulterous affair with a musician, that she has, she's a singer and he's accompanied her, and he becomes more and more convinced that they're having an affair, although we don't know in reading the story that she has. And in the end, he kills her.
And you never find out if she really did it?
No, you don't know. He goes sort of mad and he kills her. And the whole story is told by the husband, who explains that he's killed his wife on a train. So Tony Tanner talks about that one, but not about Anna Karenina. Nevertheless, he makes the point that in the bourgeois society of the 19th century, then marriage was understood as a contract, or as Dr. Cowan mentioned, a social contract. All right, so if you look at it this way, you can say, well, what is love? And I remember many years ago when I was a freshman, I was speaking with a priest friend of mine who was an administrator here at the University of Dallas. And I was a little perplexed by Tristram and Isolde, the medieval story. And I said, you know, they die, but they don't seem to be punished. I said, in fact, their love seemed to be exalted. And he said, well, you know, in the Middle Ages, marriage was more a social institution than a religious institution, though it was, of course. By the way, it's fairly late that marriage is made into a sacrament. I don't know if you knew that. And by the way, you know, a celibate clergy emerged only late in the Middle Ages. I don't know if you knew that either. So don't think things have been the way they are now since the beginning of time. They ain't. So I was perplexed by this, but then he said, well, you know, a genuine love between two people is greater than any social or secular and even some ecclesiastical institutions. And I thought about that, and I thought, oh, that puts a different light on it. I did not, by the way, go out immediately and commit adultery. I'll have you know that. I was smarter than that at 18.
Well, it's not married.
Well, I could have dallied with a married woman. Vronsky isn't married. But she wouldn't have anything to do with me. No, it didn't happen. I swear it didn't happen. Anyway, okay, so this is what is referred to as the conscience of Petersburg society. Right? The one that Countess Lydia belongs to. And Anna, who knew how to get on with everyone, had during the first part of her life in Petersburg made friends in it too, but now, on her return from Moscow, that circle became unbearable to her. It seemed to her that she and all of them were only pretending. Now, this is going to be key to Anna, because throughout the novel, Anna seems to abhor, or at least she thinks she abhors, falsity. What she wants is genuineness, sincerity. And this is the way she feels about her passion as well. Her passion feels natural. It's sincere. It's open. It's great. Passion is a great risk, of course. You give yourself up to someone else. And in the expectation that person will respect you in this moment of weakness that passion represents. So there's a sense in which there is a kind of innocence in passion, as well as vulnerability. On the other hand, society wants to protect itself. And if you recall that society then behaves sort of like an organism, sort of like a kind of very large personal entity. In fact, whole nations sometimes have personalities. It's as though they are a corporate person, like Hobbes' Leviathan, you remember, that shows the state is just a whole bunch of men all kind of gathered together into the figure of a very large man. So society has its own vulnerabilities and its own concerns. There's a social consciousness that you could say is the equivalent in society of what tradition is in literature. This is the background against which you work. This is where you start. So Anna has become disillusioned with it because it seemed to her that it is not what it represents itself as being, this conscience of Petersburg society. The third circle with which Anna was connected was society in the accepted meaning of the word. Now, you notice that, very interesting. This is the usual meaning of the word society. And so Tolstoy is deconstructing, as it were, analyzing, but also revealing in his analysis, something we don't normally recognize, that there isn't just society, as we call it. Society rules this. There are all kinds of currents and eddies within society. And, you know, you may be in serious trouble if you get trapped in one of those minor eddies. At some point and get sucked in. So this is the society which clung to the court with one hand lest it should sink to the demi-monde. For this, the members of that society thought they despised. This is the bourgeois, of course, the demi-monde, the middle class. Though its tastes were not only similar, but identical with their own. Now, Tolstoy has set the stage now for something that we have to bear in mind as we read this novel, because this is the background. These are the strata then that are going to determine not just what Anna is revolting against, but it also determines the way Anna acts, because she is still governed by these things, whether she realizes it or not. So let's turn over to page 129. Karenin has a regular routine, you notice. He comes home from work or his office. He studies for a while. He sees his wife. He studies for a while and perhaps works on official affairs, reads a book. This evening, he is reading a book on the papacy, and then he goes to bed. At the bottom paragraph, now we get a very interesting thing here. You notice how the narrator is rather than call him an omniscient narrator, I would prefer to call him a multi-consciousness narrator. So he can enter into the mind of any given character, and he can tell you precisely how that character is feeling or thinking. And while we're in that character's mind, then, we also develop, or we feel that the narrator develops not only an interiority, but but a sympathy for that character. So nobody in the novel is without some tinge of narratorial sympathy. He was not of a jealous disposition. Is this Karenin thinking of himself, or is it the narrator telling us objectively what he's like? We're not sure. Yeah, it's getting close to the in the free indirect style, which we get in Madame Bovary in touches here and there, where the are you familiar with the free indirect style? It's the one in which it's the form of narrative in which the narrator speaks in the third person, but all you'd have to do is to switch the pronoun to the first person, and you would be in the mind of the character thinking. She was no longer afraid. She was looking at the oncoming car with the serenity of a person watching an airplane fly away. You know, this kind of thing. That's the free indirect style. All right, so this is, we're not sure exactly where we're placed here, outside or inside. In that first sentence, jealousy, in his opinion, insulted a wife, and a man should have confidence in his wife. All right, so we're beginning to see where Alexei K, to distinguish him from Alexei V, right, where he is, as we could say, is coming from. Why he should have confidence. So that sounds good. He should have confidence in his wife. Well, yeah, why did you marry her otherwise? Right. Why he should have confidence. That is a full conviction that his young wife would always love him. He never asked himself. This is clearly something that Karenin does not know, does not think. This, we're on the outside. See, so we're on the outside, then we're on the inside, then we're on the outside, then we're on the inside. So we're given a sympathetic entry into his mind, and then we're given a critique of his mind alongside it. So he felt no distrust and therefore had confidence and assured himself that it was right to have it. Now, though his conviction that jealousy is a shameful feeling and that one ought to have confidence had not been destroyed, he felt that he was face to face with something illogical and stupid and did not know what to do. Karenin was being confronted with life, with the possibility of his wife loving somebody else. And this seemed stupid and incomprehensible to him because it was life itself. He had lived and worked all his days in official spheres which deal with reflections of life. And every time he had knocked up against life itself, he had stepped out of its way. He now experienced a sensation such as a man might feel who, while quietly crossing a bridge over an abyss, suddenly sees that the bridge is falling to pieces and that he is facing the abyss. The abyss was real life. The bridge was the artificial life Karenin had been living. It was the first time that the possibility of his wife falling in love with anybody had occurred to him, and he was horrified. All right, so you see the exact tone of that. On the one hand, we feel sorry for the man. I mean, all right, he's not the most sensitive person in the world. He is the perfect bureaucrat. He is a man who hasn't done anything wrong. He just isn't very thoughtful. A wife is a wife. She's a beautiful wife. She's a trophy wife. Let's face it. She's younger than he is. But still, it's the kind of marriage that existed then and exists now, despite all of our romantic illusions. And it is the kind of marriage that is, you might say, prone to instability. Now, how does society work with these things? It makes rules. It says the husband may wander about, but then we see that that's not right, because Dolly's reaction tells us that Steva, who thinks nothing of it, oh, well, you know, she doesn't really matter that much to me, just, you know, the French governess or the ballet dancer.
She'll understand.
Yeah, she'll figure it out. But we discover that hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, and indeed Dolly is a woman scorned, or at least she reads it that way. Tolstoy is awfully good at showing us how different people react to the same phenomenon. All right, on page 132, chapter 9 there, about the 1, 2, 3, 4, it's the fifth paragraph. Anna said what came into her head, and hearing her own words was astonished at her capacity for deception. Now remember, this is a woman who will say over and over again that she is opposed to all that's false. And yet she's suddenly startled to see her capacity for deception. Anna, I must warn you, said he. Warn me? She asked. What about? She looked so naturally and gaily at him that one who did not know her as her husband did could not have noticed anything strange either in the intonation or the meaning of her words. But for him, who knew her, knew that when he went to bed 5 minutes late, she noticed it and asked the reason, knew that she had always immediately told him all her joys, pleasures, and sorrows. For him, her reluctance to notice his state of mind or to say a word about herself meant much. He saw that the depths of her soul, till now always open, were closed to him. Now see, this is a marriage. It may not be a very good marriage, but you can bet your bottom dollar that it's a marriage, because this is the way people become in a marriage, even if it's only through habit. So we already know that there is a problem. Petersburg, we have a problem. Look on page, I just visited NASA over the Thanksgiving holiday. In case you wonder where that came from. Shklovsky would have loved it, wouldn't he? Now, I just want to point out, we're just about out of town. Out of time, I'll run for another 4 minutes and stop. But I just want to point out a few things, very brief. In chapter 11, at the beginning, we have this scene in which Anna asks Vronsky for forgiveness, which strikes us as strange. But it's because we know already, the moment she asks for his forgiveness, that she has taken the leap, that this is it, that she knows that she is cut off from everybody else at this point. And if he won't forgive her, then she's totally lost. And by the way, this is the danger point in her passion, because her passion has driven her to, you know, if you read John Donne, for example, the lovers who contract the whole world into their eyes. The two lovers make up their own world that is a kind of island unto itself. And they don't want anyone else to interfere. So this is that kind of moment, but it's also a moment of great peril. Because if anything happens to Vronsky, then Anna is doomed. If anything happens to their relationship, she's lost forever. There's nothing else for her. She has given away everything for the sake of Wronski. And let's see, let's flip over very quickly to page 184. The third paragraph from the bottom. How often during the 8 years of happy married life with his wife, when he saw others who were unfaithful wives or deceived husbands, had Karenin said to himself, how could they let it come to that? Oh, don't you know? We all say, how could she do that? Who would have thought? You know, the husband's doubtless to blame. You know, he should have kept a tighter leash on her. How did they let it come to that? How is it they do not end such a hideous state of things? Why don't they just make up? You know, and it's so easy from the outside. And it's not that difficult for Anna. And of course, that's the great paradox that you notice immediately, that it's Anna who smooths things over between Dolly and her husband. But now, when the misfortune had fallen on his own head, he not only did not think of how to end it, but did not wish to recognize it at all, and did not wish to recognize it just because it was too terrible, too unnatural. Now, you notice that unnatural, and you remember back to what Schopenhauer said? For men, it's natural. For women, it's unnatural. We already see where Karenin is coming from. I doubt that he's read Schopenhauer. He's coming from the way of the world. This is the inequity. This is the double standard that has commanded society, according to what Schopenhauer and others say. It is common practice. A husband can take a mistress, but he had better make sure that his wife and children are all right, are taken care of. If the wife finds out, well, yeah, she might get a little upset. You know, it's letting off steam, you know, because marriage is, as you realize, even in this world, which is becoming transformed, because at one point Levin even thinks, well, I could marry a peasant girl and settle down. Unthinkable. Even 10 years before the date of this novel, before the liberation of the serfs. And still unthinkable for the most part. You would not be able to show your face in society if you did that. Not that Levin cares, particularly. Although, notice, he knows his way about society. Well, all right. That's enough for today, I think. And we'll look at some more of this very fascinating novel on Thursday.